didn't know that. Sometimes I forget. Today, Robbie Watkins is going to be leading this session. Geshe-la is out at a weekend retreat that we're doing out at the farm at one of our longtime members, Nolenthus. And so he and a lot of other typical folks like Sarah, who usually sits here, and Venerable Chuki and Venerable Lamo and Geshe Sangpo and all those folks, they're all out at the retreat.
All the serious Buddhists.
All the serious Buddhists. The rest of us weekend Buddhists are still here. So anyway, you're going to lead prostrations?
Yeah.
We'll start with leading prostrations, and then we'll do some prayers, and then we'll get into the teaching.
Yeah, let's just do three prostrations if you want to, not required, but just to prepare ourselves for the discussion that's to follow. You want to leave the prostration mantra? Om Namo Manjushriye, Namo Sushriye, Namo Uttamayashriye, Soha. Om Namo Manjushriye, Namo Sushriye, Namo Uttamayashriye, Soha. Om Namo Manjushriye, Namo Sushriye, Namo Uttamayashriye, Soha.
We are going to start with some prayers. I'm trying to. We do more four immeasurables? Yes, we do, in English and Tibetan. So let's start with the four immeasurables. They're at the top of the brown or beigeish page. Well, first we'll do Shakyamuni Buddha's mantra three times. And then the four immeasurables in English and in Tibetan. So, Taya Ta Om Mune Mune Maha Munaye Soha. Taya Ta Om Mune Mune Maha. Tayata Om Mune Mune Maha Munaye Soha. May all sentient beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. May all sentient beings be inseparable from the happiness that is free from suffering. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. Sam Chen Tan Che De Wadang Se. Now he's you, Tom. And now let's do seven green Tara mantras. Om Tari Tu Re So Ha. 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 Okay, the kids can go to their class.
I'm going to do a meditation, do a little meditation. Okay, let's begin our session together with just a short meditation. Let me get an idea here. Who's here for the very first time? How many newcomers? I think we have a fair number of newcomers. Okay, great. Glad to have you here. This is going to be a very informal session today, so I hope you'll get some benefit from it. Let's just begin with just doing a little bit of meditation. Begin by checking your posture. Back is a little bit straighter than you normally sit. Eyes either lightly closed or just slightly open. Lips are lightly closed. Head is straight on your shoulders, not tipped to one side or the other. Shoulders are down and back, so your chest is a little bit open. Upper arms are away from your torso. And typically we put our right hand on left with our thumbs touching slightly below our navel. And our legs are in a position that we find comfortable and stable. And we can begin by just settling our mind, taking three deep breaths from the abdomen expanding on the in-breath, and then coming back in on the out-breath. Now we allow our breathing to return to its normal pattern. We always begin our meditation sessions by setting our motivation. And theoretically, we've already done that during the prayers, but if we weren't paying attention or were just repeating them, we might want to refresh our motivation that we're doing this meditation together and the discussion to be of benefit to ourselves. And also to make an imprint on our mind stream so that we can be of greater benefit to our family, our friends, our coworkers, everyone we come into contact with, and ultimately, even though it seems really enormous to think this way, to all living beings, to just something as simple as sitting on a cushion quietly for a couple minutes can change my mind in a way that I can be of better benefit to all living beings. So that may seem artificial or highfalutin, but just think that way for a moment.
And having set our motivation, now we'll do a simple breathing meditation. We're just placing the consciousness on the breath, just paying attention to the movement of the breath in and out through our nostrils. Nothing more, nothing less than that. Breath in and out. We're not describing it. We're not even going to count the breaths. We're just going to directly experience breath so that consciousness and breath become one. And we'll notice right away that consciousness and breath are two. And consciousness is somewhere way away from the breath. Listening to the children outside, or there's an ache in my leg. That's fine. Just drop that thought. Come back to the breath. Over and over again. Every time your mind's wandered, gently bring it back to the breath. And that's just a simple concentration meditation that we'll do for the next few minutes.
Thank you.
And we can end our meditation session by doing what we call a dedication. We acknowledge the positive energy that we've created by doing this simple practice, and we reaffirm the wish that whatever positive energy we've created be of benefit to all living beings. As Barb said, Geshe Gelug, our resident teacher, is leading a retreat with the serious practitioners this weekend. There are about 25 people participating. So when he's absent, Sarah Brooks, who is our spiritual program coordinator, looks around for someone to a warm body to put up here. And I got the short straw this time. My name's Robbie Watkins. I've been a member here at the Center for a number of years. And so I'm going to be leading the discussion, or co-leading the what is a discussion this morning. This will be very informal. Don Brown, who is the oldest in every sense of the word member of Kadampa Center, is the first member of Kadampa Center, is going to be helping with this discussion. And Geshe Gelug, for the past few Sundays, has been teaching from a text called The Wheel of Sharp Weapons, which is a wonderful text, but I'm not qualified to continue his teachings, so we're going to take a little break from that. And we were talking around a couple of ideas and realized that tomorrow night, a new cycle of discovering Buddhism is starting. And if people aren't familiar with discovering Buddhism, I wanted to talk a little bit about that. That's an official course of study that was designed by the FPMT, our parent organization, the Foundation for the Preservation of the Mahayana Tradition, which is a real mouthful. We call it the FPMT. It's a worldwide organization of about 170 centers similar to ours. And a number of years ago, they designed a course called Discovering Buddhism. It's a series of 14 modules covering the entire teachings of the Buddha in a very organized manner, what's traditionally referred to as the Lam Rim, or graduated path, but we don't really use that term that much in discovering Buddhism. But it's divided up into 14 modules. At Kadampa Center, we teach them on Monday nights. Each module is typically 5 to 6 Monday nights. Then there may be a week's break, then the next module starts. The first module, which I'm leading, begins tomorrow night, is about the nature of the mind, which is kind of the foundation of all of Buddhist studies, and that will be going on for 5 weeks, I think. And then the other modules are death, karma, rebirth, suffering. Yeah, it does sound kind of gloomy.
Yeah, we talked about it.
Cyclic existence, relating to a spiritual teacher, developing compassion. But there are 14 of those. And if you go through all 14 of those, which a number of people here have, you really have a really solid foundation for all the teachings that are given here at Kadampa Center. So if you're interested, I'd encourage you to come tomorrow night. All the Discovering Buddhism modules are led by Westerners. I do some. Don does some. See, Shanka, is he in the room? Shanka's outside, but Shanka leads some, and then we have some other people who may be participating. And there's no pre-registration necessary. Just show up. It's from 7 to 8:30. If you're first time, you'll probably get here about 6:45. And there's a CD-ROM in the bookstore right to the right of the front door, Discovering Buddhism, that has all the materials in it that you'll need if you do the entire module. So, with that coming up, we thought we'd do a little advertisement for Discovering Buddhism, not just for this module, but for the whole course.
There's no charge for
No charge, yeah. It's all on a donation basis, like everything here at Kadampa Center. Who here has done the whole sequence of Discovering Buddhism modules? Yeah, got a couple people that. Okay. Yeah, a couple potential leaders, yeah. Yes, yeah, right, yeah. Yeah, to completely finish the course, you have to do 100,000 prostrations and a couple other little things that might tie you up your weekend for a little while. But, yeah, otherwise. Yeah, exactly. Anyway, so Don and I were talking about this, and we realized that there are certain questions that come up over and over and over again in Discovering Buddhism. And they come up because they're good questions. And, you know, we're not saying we get tired of listening to them, but it's very interesting that there's certain questions about Buddhism in particular and Tibetan Buddhism that come up. And initially Don wanted to do something like a David Letterman's 10 list of the top 10 questions asked in Discovering Buddhism. But we came up with more than 10, yeah. So I'm going to let Don talk a little. These are some of the frequently asked questions in Discovering Buddhism, and we're going to kind of throw some of them out and have a discussion about them this morning.
First of all, we didn't want to. This came together. This list came together yesterday morning at coffee, and we didn't want to put Chris on the spot and say, "Hey, can you project it?" So we're going to get. Sarah Brooks is going to scold me for giving out a handout. And we also thought maybe we'd have some sort of meter, you know, like this question, which is the most interesting question. But we're just going to open it up and let people guide the discussion, or at least drive the discussion. And then I think from Robbie and I side, we don't claim to have all the answers. In fact, we don't have all the answers. And I would encourage you. I would encourage you to be very skeptical about anything that we say, because I mean that's the Buddhist. Isn't that the Buddhist way? I mean, you really have to examine the teachings and see if it fits your experience. So we're gonna we have, you know, collectively, you know, done these classes for quite a while, and we've heard teachings, and somebody might have a comment that may not quite jive with our understanding of what the Tibetan Buddhist tradition might say. And so if that happens, I remember Geshe-la, he's done this a few times. He's just let the discussion go all over the place. And he says, well, from my understanding, this is what the Buddhist tradition has to say about it. So Robbie and I will, to the best of our ability, represent the Buddhist tradition as we understand it. But we want to open this up because these are some juicy topics. So we have, there's your copy.
Okay. Yeah.
I don't know why I bolded some of these words, but can a couple of people hand them out, please? And so we're just going to keep our mouths shut and let people look at this. And if you have another question that's completely off, not one of these, it's certainly welcome. But these are the ones that have come up over collectively 40 years of teaching Discovering Buddhism. And these are common questions. So it's fun to talk about them.
Yeah, why don't you just read through them so people understand
okay.
What the questions are.
All right, the first one is the notion. And I have to admit, when I first got introduced to Buddhism, I was raised Presbyterian, so I'm going, where's God? Where's God? You know, because this is a theistic, this culture basically has a theistic perspective. Really worked hard on that one for a lot of years. But what's the notion of God in Buddhism? Buddhism and relationships. Big challenge there. Buddhism and religion are no fun. A lot of people are not interested in religion or Buddhism or anything that's going to take them away from their fun, whatever that looks like. Ethical living is no fun. You lose your spontaneity. There's no freedom. It's burdensome, you know. This is kind of an attitude that is prevalent in our culture. Then the whole, this one's loaded, but sexuality and Buddhism. It's a big subject. A lot written
loaded?
About that.
Why is that loaded, Don?
Well, we'll come back to that. I'm sure it'll come up. Monasticism and celibacy is not normal. I don't get it. enlightenment is not possible, at least not for me. You know, we all have, as Lamayeshi would say, you know, basically we have a spiritual inferiority complex. We identify with our gross, limited self rather than our Buddha nature, our Buddha potential. Should I raise my children as Buddhist? Push my trip on them, brainwash them? They'll be seen as outliers and weirdos. You know, should I, you know? And we have a lot of parents here who bring their children. And that's a question that, at least I'm a parent, I have three girls, and it definitely has crossed my mind. You can't prove rebirth and karma. Can't prove it. Sorry. Can't prove it. Do you have to believe everything in Buddhism? 100% responsible for everything in my life. That's what Buddhism is really saying. Hey, everything you have is up. Everything that you see, everything that you experience from the moment you're born until the moment you die is of your own creation. We are never, ever a victim. That's a hard one because that's not how we think. That's not how we ordinarily see our lives as being 100% responsible. But according to the laws of causality, that in the Buddhist perspective, we are. That's a hard one for a lot of people. Do I need to be a Buddhist to practice Buddhism? Do I need a guru? What about problems with gurus? What about spiritual friends? What is the place for devotion in Buddhism? Some people see the devotional practices as kind of a sign of weakness or kind of like, that's not for me. It's kind of off-putting for some people. What about all these statues, all this iconography? This is really weird. This is not part of my culture. What does all this mean? Graven images and stuff, you know, thou shalt bow, what is it? Thou shalt not bow down to graven images. I mean, that conversation's in our head, isn't it? I'm not into rituals. This is a big one for a lot of us. A lot of people, when, you know, I had, you know, rituals are turn-off for a lot of people. However, we all have rituals, don't we? Get up in the morning, you go to the bathroom, you go get your coffee, you get dressed, whatever you do. We have rituals. So we want to talk about, if people have questions about the rituals in Buddhism. I have a good friend who actually was involved in the early days of Kadampa Center, and she doesn't come anymore because she's not into the rituals. It's too ritualistic for her. So I know that's a problem for some people. Guilt versus regret. We get a little bit more into the teachings here, but guilt is not a Buddhist notion. Blind faith versus reason faith. Like, Buddhism doesn't require it. Faith is crucial. It's very, very important, but blind faith is actually discouraged. And because it there's no, when the chips are down, problems, it doesn't sustain you. And then, as Robbie was talking about earlier, Buddhism is so negative. Dukkha is a Sanskrit word for unsatisfactoriness, suffering, da-da-da-da-da-da, just on and on, all kinds of, just the problematic, what it means to be a human being, birth, sickness, old age, and death, and so on and so forth, death and impermanence. We talk about these things, and a lot of people are turned off by that. Perfection of generosity. We'll get a chance to pass the offering bowl. And some people think, oh, that's just another gimmick for getting money. You know? We need money. Can't get the money thing right. I try to be a good person. I don't need the Buddhist religious trip. I'm not a joiner. A lot of people that come here are not joiners. I've heard that forever. Retreats and meditation aren't necessary. I practice mindfulness during my daily life. That's enough. That's a common misconception.
Retreats aren't necessary. Yeah, you're speaking to the choir.
We all agree they're not necessary. Because if they were, we'd be out on Nolan's land right now.
Yeah.
All right. Now this is kind of a good one. Being compassionate and humble equals being a doormat, right? Being a doormat. Can compassion, and underneath that is a question: can compassion and inner strength and wrathfulness coexist? And then you know, for those of you who've done discovering Buddhism, I usually teach the introduction to Tantra class, and you know, for a lot of people in the West who don't understand Tibetan Buddhist Tantra, they just think it's just some kind of esoteric sexual practice, and that it's not even part of the Buddhist tradition. And then another question is, what's Dharma practice? And then there's thousands more that have come up over the years. So your questions or your comments don't even have to come from this sheet of paper, but these are a subset. I'm freezing, so.
Yeah, it goes up and down. Yeah, it was too warm, now it's too cold.
Yeah.
Let's see if it evens out. Yeah, okay.
So, Ravi,
okay.
Could you answer all these questions, please?
I mean, which question, are these questions that people have asked or thought about? I mean, do some of these speak to people? Somebody want to jump on one?
And yeah. Let's use the microphone, so.
Yeah. Somebody just want to take one and say something about it? Okay, Andre.
Andre's never lost the words.
In fact, it's very traditional in Buddhism, in the Tibetan tradition, that you actually debate some of the issues like these. And that's an important way of learning. So maybe if we get to an appropriate point, we'll do a little debating. I'll take Andre down or something.
Have at it. Mine is the very first one.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Notion of God from a Buddhist point of view. I was a Christian missionary for 25 years of my life before.
Andre teaches Buddhism in the prison system. He's also one of the lay teachers here at Kadampa Center.
Yeah. And so when I came here, I met Sheriff. At Himalayan Frontier, he's the one that introduced me to the Kadampa Center. And I've been reading on Buddhism, and so I had all these questions. And so I wanted a mala. I didn't know why I wanted a mala, but I really wanted a mala. I felt this need to get a mala. And so I went to his store. To get one, and he wasn't there. He was off in, I think, Nepal. He was buying some stuff for his store. So I met his wife, and I was talking to her, and she said, "Well, you have to meet Sheriff. You have to meet Sheriff. He can answer your questions and stuff like that." And so I remember just waiting and waiting and waiting for Sheriff to come back, and it was like Christmas, right? I was just waiting and waiting, and he came. And he spent. I mean, this just really blew my mind because he spent a half a day with me. His customers were coming in, and he answered my questions. And one of my first questions was this idea about God, and about Jesus, and about enlightenment, and so forth, and Buddhas, in Buddhism, we believe that the Christ was a bodhisattva, and not only a bodhisattva, but he was a Buddha, you know. And I thought that was just really, really, I thought that was beautiful. Anyway, he said I had to come to the Kadampa Center, so I went to the Kadampa Center. Then I started hearing about these things about, you know, like, well, we don't believe in God. God doesn't exist. The Buddha said that God, that there's no God. For myself personally, I've never read anywhere where Buddha said there was no God. I don't know. It might be.
I don't
might
know
be
if
in
he
literature.
Said those words or not. Yeah. He doesn't talk about.
He doesn't talk about it. Yeah. I've never seen.
His model of the universe. There
right,
is no
yeah.
God in it. Yeah.
But when I started asking questions about that, that's what I would hear. No, the Buddha said there's no God and stuff like that. And so I thought. But I remember as a Christian, I had some experiences. I mean. Through prayer, and you know, it seemed like to me it's like the room would just open up with light, you know. And I remember in prayer, I would just tears would just start flooding, you know. And I had this experience, and I would actually not hear an audible voice, but I could hear what I felt was the voice of God, and that stays with me today. And so as I was asking questions, I began to realize maybe I'm asking the wrong people. You know, because of course you're going to say there's no God, right? You know, this is their mindset. This is their belief.
Yeah.
And so I just stopped asking the questions. You know? And so for myself personally, I believe there's something. I don't know what that something is. But I personally believe that there's something. And so I just stick with that.
Okay. Anybody want to take on Andre on that?
I don't know if there's a God. I know that from my time with the 12-step program that I was in need of a higher power, something mm-hmm. more than myself. And I have that image that I have created for that higher power. But I think it's all perception.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever it is that you need to believe in or want to believe in, you can make yourself do it by the perception, by that's the way I'm going to look at things. Because if I remember hearing saying, everybody think of a coffee cup. Picture a coffee cup in your mind. And I said, but my coffee cup probably doesn't look like your coffee cup because you have a different perception of what I've asked. So maybe that might be what is going on, is just all our perceptions of what we think or what we might need in this
life.
You're
a Buddhist and didn't know it. Yeah. Definitely. That's definitely a Buddhist idea.
I've had experiences similar to Andre, and I know any number of other people who've had similar experiences. But dogma will break your heart. Buddhist, Muslim, Christian, Jewish, it will break your heart and it will hurt your little head.
Mm-hmm.
And personally, I think you have to make it up. You have to make it up for yourself. I doubt there's anybody in this room who buys into everything that's being said.
Mm-hmm.
Again, you really, really have to make your own way. And you find yourself going to war with religion, which I frequently do. Good luck to you.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that, I think when I hear you say make it up, I think what the Buddha said was test everything against your own experience.
Absolutely.
And keep what you find useful.
Absolutely.
And don't, if it doesn't jive with your experience, there's no obligation, even if you're a card-carrying Buddhist, to accept it. Yeah, it has to. Everything has to be judged against your own experience. And, you know, this is a little bit off the topic, but His Holiness the Dalai Lama has said many times that if modern science disproves any of the Buddhist teachings, we are obligated as thinking human beings to discard the teaching that's disproved. You know, again, we have to always be testing against our experience and our reality.
I just want to reiterate, you know, about the experience, because experience is my truth.
Mm-hmm.
And I too also have been involved and involved with the 12-step program. But I like to tell you a story. A few years back, I got invited to go to the Staples Center in California to see the Clippers play basketball. And the guy that says, you can have anything you want. You know, it's on the company card. Get anything you want. And I ordered a French dip with French fries and a large iced tea. And the waitress that came down asked him what he wanted. He said, I'll have the same thing, but I'll have a Heineken. And she looks at me and she says, do you want to have a Heineken too? And I went, no, thank you. Iced tea will be just fine.
Uh-huh.
She goes back up. She comes back down. She brings us our food, gives him my iced tea, gives him his Heineken. And she goes, it's going to be about 20 minutes before I get back here. Is there anything else I can get you, boys? And he says, by the time you get back, I'll be finished with this Heineken. Bring me another. And she looks at me again and says, do you want a Heineken? I said, I'm like, no, thank you. She goes back up. She comes back down 20 minutes later, and she asks me again one more time. And she says, do you sure you don't want a Heineken? I said, let me tell you what's going to happen if I have a Heineken. I'm not going to have one Heineken. I'm going to have 10 or 12. I'm going to get really drunk. I'm going to start acting like a jerk. And I'm going to harass all these nice people sitting next to me, you know. And she went up. She said, okay. She says, never mind. And she goes back up. She comes back down, and she asks me one more time, would you like to have a Heineken? Everybody next to me went, no. Can you hear what he said? You know, and I've, what I'm coming to find out in life is that, you know, I have to be true to thine own self, be true,
mm-hmm.
whatever the case may be. And I've been coming here for a few weeks, and it has been benefiting me.
Mm-hmm.
I've lost some weight. I've been able to focus on it.
Mm-hmm.
I've dropped maybe 15, 16 pounds since I've been here. I was weighing about 230, and now I weigh 215, and I'm loving it. And it's been benefiting me in so many ways, spiritually, when I sleep, you know. Work, it's a little tougher because it's a hard job, but it's been helping me. And the more I come, I don't know about getting enlightened or anything like that, but the more I show up, the more benefit I get out of it. So that's what's been working for me.
Okay.
So I want to throw a couple of things out that that I've heard over the years from Buddhist teachers about the notion of God. There's in Thailand, there was a great Buddhist teacher named Ajahn Buddhadasa, Buddhadasa Bhikkhu, and I was visiting his monastery. This is many years ago, and he had written many books, and he was considered to be a bit of an iconoclast within the Thai Buddhist culture. But the very first lecture I went to him, he said that he made the statement, "There is a God in Buddhism." You know, I'd always heard Buddhism was non-theistic, so I was going, "Oh, wonder what he's going to say about that." And he said, "Well, we're talking about God in the sense of a creative force." And he said, "It's the laws of nature. If you did this, you get that. If you do that, you get something else." In other words, it's karma, the laws of causality. What you put out comes back to you. What goes around comes around. And that's the creative force. And then another Alex Berzin is a Buddhist scholar. He used to visit Kadampa Center fairly regularly. And Alex addresses this question a little differently. He says, "Well, if you ask 100 people what God is, you're going to get 100 different answers. Everybody's got their own perspective about God. But there's the omnipotent, okay, all-knowing. Okay, well, in Buddhism, we have that. That's called enlightenment. So omnipotence, if God is, equals omnipotence, Buddhism says, well, we all have that potential.
Omniscience.
Omniscience, sorry. Omniscience. Yeah, like, you know, omnipotence is a little bit of a problem. Omniscience, we all have the potential. Omnipotence, well, that's a little bit of a problem, isn't it? Because the God that I was raised is all-powerful, can do anything. But the Buddhist response to that is, well, why is there suffering? If there's a compassionate, kind, all-powerful God, why is this place such a mess? Yeah, why are these little babies born with birth defects? Why are people killing each other? Why is there so much exploitation and so on and so on? The whole suffering thing. So that one doesn't quite jive with the Buddhists who are thoughtful about it. They don't go for that. Then there's a notion of omnipresence. God is everywhere. Well, there's one of the features of enlightened consciousness is that when Robbie Watkins, who's probably already enlightened, we just don't know it yet, he's not telling us, but when any of us become enlightened, when we become enlightened, our consciousness pervades the universe. It said, you know, I got a text from Lama Zopa's attendant, and at the end of her little email messages, she always has this little thing, says, "Buddhas are everywhere." And they want to help us. We just have to ask for help. We just have to be open to their enlightening influence. So there is a sense that, and they even say in the text, even on the head, on the that like the tip of a needle, there are like billions of Buddhas there. You know, it sounds sort of bizarre.
Many Buddhas condensed on the head of a pin.
Yeah, something like that. But enlightened consciousness pervades the universe, and so there is something outside of us, but. Again, the creative forces are our own choices, our own actions. We can benefit from these enlightened beings, but we have to have created the karma for that. So what do we got? Omniscience, omnipresence, omnipotence.
No omnipotence.
No omnipotence, yeah.
Yeah.
And there's one
three.
More omni. I can't remember what it would be.
Omnivore.
Carnivore. Oh, so anyway, it's you know, but the whole, I think the thing that's much, oh, and this is what Buddhadasa Bhikkhu said too. He said Buddhism has a God. It's a cause of, he said the laws of nature, if you do this, you get that. And he said it's an impersonal God. It's not personal. Karma's not personal. If you harm someone and then you get harmed, it's not personal. It's just the laws of nature. It's just how things exist. This is the Buddhist perspective.
It's like gravity. Gravity is impersonal.
Yeah, gravity doesn't care. You know, it doesn't really have, it's not a personal thing. It just is the way things work. And so, you know, from a Buddhist perspective, if we want to be happy, which we all do, then we have to create the causes for happiness. And if we want to continue to suffer, Buddhism is real clear about the causes of suffering. And it says, look, stop doing that. You can keep doing it if you want to, but just pay attention and just notice how it keeps you stuck. You can never get out. So, anyway.
Yeah. You know, people who are in comparative religions would definitely say that Buddhism is a non-theistic religion, one of the very few in the world. There's, I think, some sects of Jainism are non-theistic. And there may be a Hindu sect that's non-theistic, but just about every other religion does posit a creator God. So that, you know, that again, that's just the textbook answer that Buddhism is non-theistic. I wonder if maybe anyone who's been studying Buddhism for a while, if they had a problem with that, going from being raised in a very theistic-oriented society to a philosophy that's more non-theistic. Yeah.
I have a problem with it.
Yeah, I certainly did. Like I said, 25 years of, you know, and that's just, you know, like when you guys were like in Nepal and stuff, learning all about what the Buddha taught, I was at that age, 18 years old, I was 19, 20 years old and so forth. I was studying what the Christ taught and stuff. So, you know, it's like, and then, of course, before that, right? I mean, I was brought up Christian, so I had, you know, I really had this, you know, these ideas and stuff. And so when I really struggled with this idea of no God, because I thought we place all of our hopes, our dreams, you know, all the responsibility we place this on this being, you know, and so when things go well for us. Well, you know, like, well, thank you, Jesus. Thank you, God. You know, when things don't go well for us, it's your fault. You know, we put all of our expectations, all of our hopes on this. And so it becomes quite natural, you know, for us to do that. And so I didn't understand about personal responsibility, really. You know, just, you know, saying, you know, like, no, this is my mess. You know, I can't expect, you know, God or someone else to clean it up for me. Mm-hmm. That was really, really tough for me. So I really struggled. That's why.
And these are your good things also. Yeah. Mm-hmm. The good things also you're responsible for.
I'm responsible for it. I definitely didn't get that one. You know, you know, it's like, because I would beat myself up all the time, you know, and so forth. Mm-hmm. I certainly didn't get that one. But so for me, once I got that, though, that was really, really liberating. Once I got that, no, it's incumbent upon me, you know. This is my mess. Instead of waiting for God or waiting for someone else to clean it up, I clean it up myself. So for me, that was empowering. And so then I really took hold of that. So, but I really struggled with it a lot. In fact, sometimes I thought, I just can't do this thing. I had no problem with the images and bowing down to graven images or what have you. You know, I mean, we got crosses of Christ, we got images of Christ, and we do these kinds of things. That didn't bother me, but the idea that there's no God, you know, because that means now it's on me, you know, and that was kind of tough.
Quick, for me, it was the opposite because I grew up Catholic, and I think for a lot of the time I was feeling like there wasn't. I didn't like the idea of God. Mm-hmm. I think that's why I ended up here. Mm-hmm. The idea of God really you know, me not being responsible was bothering me
mm-hmm.
because I felt like I didn't want somebody else to be responsible. You know, you feel so helpless that there's something out there
mm-hmm.
steering your life, yeah. supposedly, and that didn't make sense, and it didn't make sense scientifically
yeah.
either.
Yeah, so. I think I came from a similar yeah. point of view, yeah.
I was just going to start on another question unless anyone else wanted to like reiterate.
Let's see, was there one comment over here?
Yes. Yeah.
And then we can go, yeah, then we'll let you choose the next question. Joanna, did you want to say? Okay. Okay. Pick the next question.
I was going to talk about like the view of like relationships
okay.
within this religion, because I know that it's not encouraged, and I was wondering, you know, if it is looked down upon, because, you know, there are a lot of people here and a lot of people that I know that are Buddhist that, you know, are married and all that other stuff. So I was just wondering, I know it's not encouraged, but is it necessarily looked down upon? And because I know that this is like a focus for like finding your own enlightenment, but also like, is that just the main reason? Or, you know, I was very it might take a long time for it to answer.
That's,
might not get
that's
answered
fine.
Today,
okay.
but you know.
Yeah.
I'm just it didn't really get covered in our class, and so that's always
yeah.
been a question.
Okay. Mark. Anybody got any experience with
so
relationships?
So your question is, your comment is, you think that relationships may be looked down upon as a hindrance to spiritual
yes.
development, and maybe. And not encourage.
We should all be monks and nuns.
Yeah.
Is
that kind of what your question is?
Yeah.
Is
it, I know it's not, but is it like necessarily like looked down upon for the religion and sort of like why? Like, is more to it than just like the
mm-hmm.
mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. The floor is open.
Anyone in a relationship? Yeah.
Related with your own
Buddhism. Yeah, let's hear. Yeah, okay. Joanna. Yeah.
I'm married, and I was actually practicing Buddhism for several years.
Joanna, could you hold mic a little closer?
Before my husband began coming here. And in fact, Don early on asked me about whether it was a problem. My husband's name is Patrick. Whether or not it was a problem for Patrick. And I said, no, he supports it. And Don said, well, that's very good, because oftentimes it can be a problem within a relationship. It can be divisive. And so I was fortunate that Patrick was very supportive. But I find, briefly, I find a relationship and a marital relationship a great place to practice. You cannot believe the challenges that come up. And
yeah, Patrick's not here. Tell us about that.
I better. But like anything else in life, relationships are not looked down upon. I mean, monks and nuns are celibate. I mean, but as a general rule, they're not looked down upon. Householders, as Buddhists, is a long tradition. And it's a great place to practice. That's all I can say.
Mm-hmm. You know, and you know, just to add on what Joanna said, it's like the Buddha had a monastic order, and the people who had the karma for that were drawn to it. He never said you had to be a monk or a nun. But people who wanted to practice, you also have to understand the context of that particular time, but even now. But if you got married and started having kids, you might end up with a dozen, you know, during your reproductive life. I mean, you would have very little opportunity to practice, to do spiritual practice. So, you know, it's not everybody has that sort of inclination to do intensive spiritual practice, but the people who did, the monastic order was, people were invited to join the monastic order, and even within lay Buddhism, in you know, celibacy, for example, there's some lay practitioners that take something called the eight precepts, where they never become a monastic, but they choose to be celibate, and then People who go off to retreat, you know, for 3 days or 3 months might choose to live the life, literally a monastic life, really focusing very deeply on their spiritual practice. And I remember in Thailand, at this particular monastery where I was staying for a while, they would tell me about these businessmen who would be home taking care of their families for 9 months out of the year, and during the rainy season they would come to the monastery. You can do this in Thailand. Shave their heads, take monastic vows, and during the rainy season do intensive spiritual practice for 3 months. Then take the robes off, you know, basically drop the vows that they'd taken, and go back and be a family person and raise their children and earn money and all of this. It's kind of amazing how it works. It's never, you know, Buddhism wants us to be happy. The Buddha, I think, wants us to be happy, and there's a lot of different paths for people. There's not like one path.
And I think part of what, when we get into relationships, when we talk about that, there's the attachment issue. I think that's the bigger part of what a lot of folks talk about. You know, when you're in an intimate relationship with somebody, there's a lot of the attachment going on, especially early on when you're first meeting people, and the sexual attraction stuff and all that kind of stuff is getting into, you know, unrealistic expectations, all those kinds of things. And I think having a relationship with another person, because nobody, monks, nuns, everybody is having relationships with other people. You always are interacting with other people. It's just on different levels. And, you know, the level of, you know, what your expectation is of that other person and the relationship. And, you know, you start making up those stories in your head about, oh, they're the most wonderful person in the world. If I lose them, I'm going to die. All those kinds of things. That's the dangerous part of a relationship. But when you're in that supportive, like, I've been married 25 years to that guy over in the corner over there, and then he, you know, we both decided to start coming here, and it's been, you know, almost all we talk about a lot of times comes back around to Dharma. And I mean, it's really cool to have somebody 24 hours in your life that you are participating in this path with. You know, put aside all the other parts about marriage, but, you know, we handle problems based on Dharma sometimes, you know, we get into arguments, and then we can come back and say, you know, yeah, you know, we were both thinking really stupidly, and from a Buddhist perspective, we should have done this, things like that. So it's really cool to be in a neat relationship like that. It's different.
Let's see, I think I've seen a hand in the back a couple of ways.
Yeah.
All right, back
on. I was thinking, I remember something that was taught, maybe it was a few months ago, that love, as far as the Buddhist philosophy, is equals compassion. And that is not the romance novel type love story thing that we have here. I speak for myself, though, and I'm sure that there's at least one other person in this room that likes that idea of love and wants to be loved and to share and have a loving relationship with someone. I understand that we all make choices in our life, and there's consequences for everything that we choose, whether they be good or bad. I can see where the attachment, if you get too attached to a person, that will create some suffering in your life at some point. I know that in my life, I choose to accept those and be aware of the suffering that I am also going to set myself up at some point, because the love that I have is worth it to me. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of like the payoff. Am I getting enough out of it to make it worth it? And for me, it does. But I am aware that at some point, whether it be death or any other reason that intimate relationship would happen, that one of us is going to be gone from the other one at some point. And there will be sadness, and I know that I know that will be felt. But what I get out of the relationship far exceeds and makes it worth it to me to have to go through that, because I get so much more from a relationship. And as far as relationships with me and Andre, or or anybody that I'm coming in contact, we're all in a relationship. But again, I think it's that perception thing. It's that in the 12-step program, they talk about acceptance. And acceptance is the answer to all my problems, page 452. Now, when you think about it, if I could accept everything that happens in my life, I will be serene because I won't, nothing will bother me. The problem is, as all things, it's a easy thing to say, but a very hard thing to do. Yeah. And it is, it's practice, not perfection. Yeah. So as long, the way I see it is, as long as I keep trying to go towards that path, I may never reach whatever it is the end might be, but if I can improve each day just a little bit, then I think I'm doing okay.
Just to jump in with a few pieces of the party line. The Buddhist definition of love is the wish that the other person be happy. It's not that they be happy with me, okay, but they be happy. So it kind of implies that that attachment part is not part of love. Also, if you accept the idea of rebirth, countless previous lifetimes, countless future lifetimes, we've all been married in previous lifetimes, we've been monks and nuns in previous lifetimes, we've all experienced all of it. So we've all had that experience. And it's considered to be the result of very good karma to become a monastic in this lifetime. But it's also the result of very good karma to find a mate, you know, who is sympathetic and supports your spiritual practice. And I don't think there's any kind of looking down on people who are not monastics. There are lots of stories about people who are married with families becoming enlightened. So it's just what works for you in this lifetime and what's best for your spiritual progress.
Yeah, and I was going to also say, I've been married now for 31 years, and I got to tell you straight up, you know, it hasn't been easy, and it was Buddhism that actually saved my marriage. It was these teachings. When I came here, my wife and I, we were on a rocky path, you know, a lot of it due to my own anger issues and stuff like that, you know, and so my experience has been that Buddhism has actually deepened the relationship. And my wife is not a Buddhist. She supports. We have wonderful conversations about these things. I mean, these are universal ideas. These ideas, as has been said many times before, at least Rabina says, weren't created by the Buddha. You know, these are universal principles. These are universal ideas. You know, and so they work. So when I'm talking with people in relationships all the time, I'm a teacher. I teach at Wake Tech, and when I'm talking to my students and my coworkers who are Christians and who have other faiths, I never have any problem at all because I see them as universal ideas and I present them as universal ideas, not as the, I got the truth, you know, and therefore. Now, I do the same thing with my wife and with my daughter, you know. I talk about these things in a very universal way, in a way that anyone can understand and anyone can accept. So there's not a problem with relationships in Buddhism from my own perspective. It's actually deepened my relationship with my wife and with my daughter, with my coworkers, my friends, with my dog. You know, it's like my dog is really happy to see me. You know, instead of having his tail between his legs, you know, really happy to see me. This is wonderful, you know. So, yeah, relationships, I think, are just really wonderful. Really wonderful.
Man's best friend.
Okay.
Can I just take one quick?
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Just a quick thought. I was reading one time on FPMT advice and on the newsletter. I was just looking at Lama Yeshe, and it reminded me, I thought, it was advice on marriage, and so it just kind of struck me funny that let's see what a monk has to say. Advice on marriage. You've never been married? But it was so simple, but it's beautiful. It's just, can you cherish each other? So we always talk about cherishing everyone else, and the path to happiness is cherishing everyone. But if you cherish each other completely, and that includes yourself too, then you're in the relationship constantly thinking, what is going to help this person be happy, and what is going to help this person get to their be on their path, not on your path with you, but on their own path. So you each have to walk on your own path. Where you meet is a different path, but you have to stay on your own. And so if you find someone who can help you stay on your own path, I think that would be a very good way to be in a relationship.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I was thinking, you know, when we talk about relationships, we talk a lot about attachment and, you know, dealing with that. But I was also thinking about equanimity coming up a lot, too, because, I mean, even not just with my husband, but also with children, I definitely favor people in my life over other people. Mm-hmm. And I know that that can also sort of raise issues. It's hard for me to wrap my head around that. I love most children, but I definitely love my children more, you know? So, you know, that can definitely be hard for me to get into sometimes. I think it's, you know, so I think it's not something that's frowned upon at all by most Buddhists. We all want to love our children.
Yeah.
But, equanimity can be challenging, or even during the elections, right? Yeah. I mean, there are certain people.
I think we can misinterpret also. In the traditional teachings, equanimity is a quality that we have to develop true compassion. And equanimity is defined as not holding some people close and pushing others away and being indifferent towards others. But it's a very tricky concept, because it doesn't mean being equally indifferent to everybody, okay? It really means, you know, the way I think of it, it means seeing everybody as equally worthy of having happiness and becoming enlightened, okay? Which doesn't mean, you know, of course you're going to feel closer to your children. You know, Buddha can feel equally close to everyone, but, you know, just if we can just start to look and see, you know, how many people, you know, we just write off, you know, and we want to, you know, start to weaken that a little bit. And how many, there's some people we love them, but we also just cling to them, and we want to let go of that aspect of it. But it's not like we get to the point where we don't care about anybody. That's not the goal of equanimity at all. If we think that, you know, it's very easy to go too far.
Yeah. I want to say something about attachment, too, because Every so often I see Gershel, and I say, he says, "Don, how's it going?" And I'll say, "I'm too attached to my kids." And it's true. I mean, you know, as a parent, you just, you love your kids so much, and you want them to be happy, and you cannot imagine, you know, you just don't want to do anything to ever upset them. But in Buddhism, there's afflictive emotions. In other words, all attachment is not afflictive. Okay? The afflictive attachment is the one where we project qualities, you know, desire, attachment, clinging. We're talking about basically the same thing, where we project qualities beyond what's actually there. We believe in the projection, and then we mentally grasp onto it. That's the problematic one. You know, the qualities can be there. I mean, people do have qualities, right? People are beautiful. People are ugly. People are everything in between. You know, and but we believe in our projections, particularly if they're positive, and we cling to it, and that's the problem. So in a relationship, be it with a spouse or children or whatever it is, it's, you know, if, as a Buddhist for me, it's being aware that I'm doing that. And as much as I can, loving my kids without clinging. Just kind of let go. That's the opposite of attachment is non-attachment, letting go. Mm-hmm. So I think in relationships, it's a work in progress.
Yeah. I've got to tell them what Geshe-la said when Hannah was born. When Don's second daughter was born, Geshe-la says, "Oh, good, you've got two now. You can give one to Robbie." I think he was joking, but
yeah, Robbie and Hannah would work. They'd be perfect together in the back. Yeah.
So this, you know, discussion has moved towards relationships, and now we're talking about permanence and impermanence. And for me, it's about change. And change, when something is not to my liking, I'm happy when it changes,
mm-hmm.
especially if it's then preferable.
Mm-hmm.
But when there's something like a relationship with a daughter or a son or, and, you know, or a marriage that's working and then it changes, that's when I think people get into trouble and get unhappy. And I think Buddhism is one of the few philosophies that gives us some strength to work with that, because in fact everything changes. That's, you know, a good marriage is, after some period of time, will not be the same marriage. It may come back again. The relationship you have with your daughters will change. Can you be accepting of that? And so when you were talking about dukkha and saying that Buddhism is negative, I actually think that Buddhism, whether it's Tibetan Buddhism, Zen Buddhism, is the most mature philosophy for dealing with life, and life is about change.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Again, when the Buddhists use the word impermanence, they refer to things changing, not that they last forever, but that they're, when we say things are impermanent, it means they're changing. And that's another, like karma, that's another one of the laws of nature, according to the Buddha. Everything's changing. And we need to wrap our minds around that. If we don't, that's the source of dukkha or suffering. Yeah. What? How are we doing on time, Barb? Oh, okay. Okay, so, yeah, maybe a couple more comments, and then we'll do our prayers. I don't think we'll get through all the questions today. Yeah. But we picked two good ones.
Hey, by the way, these are the kinds of things that when Venerable Robin is here, we could ask her, and she could probably run through this list in about 20 minutes.
My trouble is I hear you all talking, and I have like a million things I want to say, and I'm like, okay, can't say all those, no one cares, and okay, then I'm trying to sort through it all. But the one thing that especially struck my attention was what you just said about everything changes, and I remember a book by Shunryu Suzuki, Zen Buddhist. Mm-hmm. And this is the 70s, and, you know, San Francisco, and he was teaching, and the kids were really impatient, and they're like, what is this? What is this Buddhism about? And he said, everything changes. You got that? You got everything? Everything changes, and everything is interconnected. And yeah. I always, those two things, when mm-hmm. I kind of forget, I get lost in all the words, everything's interconnected. Everything changes. And so it helps me with the relationship with my husband. I heard someone ask a question of the Dalai Lama, you know, about this, you know, I'm a mother. How does that fit in? You know, how does that one? He said, well, my first teacher is my mother. You know, she taught me warm heart. I'm still teaching that. All things are interconnected. And then she said, well, we have to update the monastic views. You know, these things were written a long time ago. Things change. You know, women are working. This, it's a completely different world. So, you know, maybe you can find a way that as a mother, you could update these scriptures. How does that change, you know, for you? And so he put the question back to the audience, and the woman said, well, if I feel like my child is connected with me, I get so angry at them, and I'm so embarrassed when they do something wrong. And then if I feel a little bit less, not detached, it's non-attached, so it's there, we're interconnected, but we are not the same. It's a little bit different. I can handle it a little bit more with equanimity. I can handle it in a way that just works better. And so that was her response. I'll pass that on.
Yeah. Okay. Maybe one last comment. Was there a comment? Okay.
I think in talking about impermanence, I hear a lot about things changing elsewhere or in situations.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I feel like it relates a lot to enlightenment and how even every second right now, we are not the same mm-hmm. as the last second.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I think it's Ajahn Brahm, which is a Buddhist monk in the Theravada tradition, that mm-hmm. talked about how every second that we change mm-hmm. is another second that we can be enlightened, and our opportunities are endless.
Mm-hmm.
And that's
yeah. Okay. Okay.
Okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Thank you, everyone, for participating. That was great. So I'll turn it back over to Barb.
Trying to remember how we do this. A lot of times I'm not in here, so we're going to do. There's a pink sheet in your prayer book that starts with dedication verses. So we'll do those. But before that, I'm going to read the dedication list so that we can think about these folks. And Royden, while that's happening, we can do that. Somebody could help since I got to read. Joey, you want to help? Oh. Richard's helping. Okay. Prayers for a happy rebirth. All those killed by natural and man-made disasters. All the Tibetans who have been killed or have taken their own lives in the struggle for religious freedom. Nancy York Appen, Bailey, Eric Bradley, Bud, Mrs. Farrington, Dorinda Hartson, Matt Hassel, Claude Holyfield, Nita Kiesler, Linda Marion, Ned, Edward Simpson, Michelle Woodall, Alana the Cat, George the Dog, Isis the Cat, Sierra the Dog, Job Search, Eve Ahira, Beth Andrew, Jerry Kane, Daniel Cunningham, Harish Farna, Jenny Forrest, Michael Fultz, Kate Harvey, Andrea Johnson, Catherine Myers, April Rocker, Tony Sloan, Rochelle Thompson, Laurie Todd, SS, Anna Dean Silver, and Sarah. Difficulties of body and or mind. Venerable Lama Zopa Rinpoche, Lama Pema Wangduk, Venerable Chokila, all those harmed by natural and man-made disasters, for the Tibetan people and for Chinese authorities, may the nonviolent path lead to full reconciliation and religious freedom. Clem William Akins III, Denise Allen, Allison Appen, Jim Barnes, Nicole Bertrand and siblings, Bill Burke, Ron Burroughs and family, Hester Clifford, Rose Ella Coleman, Allegra Dahlquist, Larry Davis, Frank Ferreira, Kelly Forrest, Mildred Gooch, Barb and Fred Harris, Matt Hassel's families, Trip Hatley, Davis Helton, Lola Hilliard, Bill Hirsch, Claude Holyfield's family, Leslie and Joan Inman, Kenny Jackson and Buddy, Andrew Johnson, Sugi Jones, Helen Kasanoff, Shanti and Kurt Latimer, Karina Lilligan family, Aunt Lori, Alyssa Luck, Carolyn and Granger Marley, Bobby Martin, Barbara Mercer, Jamin and Pandya, Jai Pandya, Lively Pasque, Catherine Paul, Mary Peterson, Aunt Polly, Sarah Noel Quinlan and her family, Duncan Quinn, Richard Robeson, Ruben family, Paula Sable, Dr. Albert Sons, Joanna S., Greg Shario, Rosemary Cease, C.J. Smithson, Jacob Smuckler, Mamie Stark, David Underwood, Claude and Vic Williams, Suzanne Williams, Michelle Woodall's family, Judith Wormser, Casey the Dog, Fabia the Dog, Ninja the Cat, Pogo the Cat, and Skippy the Dog. So now we're going to do the dedications verses. Well, before we do that, if there's anybody else you'd like to add to the list, you can say it now or think it to yourself. And so we'll do the dedication verses on the pink sheet. May all beings everywhere, plagued by sufferings of body and mind, obtain a notion of happiness and joy by virtue of my merits. May no living creature suffer, commit evil or overfall ill. May no one be afraid or belittled, with blind made down by depression. Blind see forms and the deaf hear sounds. May those whose bodies are worn with toil be restored on finding repose. May the naked find clothing, the hungry find food. May the thirsty find water and delicious drinks. May the poor find wealth, those weak with sorrow find joy. May the forlorn find hope, constant happiness and prosperity. May there be timely rains and bountiful harvests. May all medicines be effective and wholesome prayers bear fruit. May all who are sick and ill quickly be free from their ailments. Whatever diseases there are in the world, may they never occur again. May the frightened cease to be afraid, and those bound be free. May the powerless find power, and may people think of benefiting each other.
And then we'll read the Remembering the Kindness of His Holiness, the Dalai Lama. The object of refuge of myself and of all transmigratory beings in all our lifetimes is the embodiment of the three jewels, the all-encompassing three refuges in one, the Guru, the wish-granting jewel, His Holiness the Dalai Lama, the Master Padmasambhava, the Dharma King Songtsen Gampo and Trisong Detsen, the Abbot Shantakarisha, and the numberless holy beings who preserved and spread the Buddha Dharma in Tibet, and the Tibetan people who practiced and served Buddhism so faithfully for 1,000 years, as well as those who, among many others, died sacrificing their lives for Tibet and its holiness. Hopefully the brother's wishes be fulfilled immediately. And then back to the pink sheet. In the land encircled by snow mountains, you are the source of all happiness and good. All-powerful Chenrezig Tenzin Gyatso, please remain until samsara ends. Savior of the snow line teachings and transmigratory beings, who extensively clarifies the path that unifies emptiness and compassion, to the lotus in the hand, Lord Tenzin Gyatso, I beseech, may all your holy wishes be fulfilled. The one who mastered his speech at a very young age, the one with great patience who received the name Avatara, the one who received and spread the teachings of Lama Tsongkhapa on bliss and void, Lama ornament of the yellow hat tradition, please remain until samsara ends. You who uphold the subduer's moral way, who serve as the bountiful bearer of all, sustaining, preserving, and spreading Manjana's victorious doctrine, who masterfully accomplish magnificent prayers honoring the three jewels, Savior of myself and others, your disciples, please, please live long. So we'll do 7 green Tara mantras for Geshe-la's long life. Om Tare Tu Tare Tu Re Soha. 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 Om Tare Tu Tare Tu Re So. And then 8 Chenrezig mantras. Om Mani Padme Hum. 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 Om